Public Enemy. This is a hot dog.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. On from torture to genocide, and our guest, Bill Kelsey, he's a pilot for AirServe International and has been to the Sudan lately, ferrying around UN aid workers and non-governmental organization medicine and food relief types and such like that. And he's now back in Austin, Texas to fill us in on what's going on in the Sudan. So welcome back to my show, Bill Kelsey.
Well, thank you very much.
Actually, I shouldn't say back because this is an entirely different show than the one I had you on before.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Congratulations.
hey, thanks. Look, we only have a couple of few minutes here in the first section before the first break. So before we really get into Sudan, I kind of want to ask you a little bit. Maybe you can tell us about your background and how it is that you began flying for AirServe International, what that is, and such like that.
Well, my background, my profession, I'm a pilot. I grew up in the Middle East. And
raised in Jordan, right?
Jordan, yeah. Yeah, mostly in Jordan, a little bit in Lebanon, and I've worked in the Middle East in a few places. And so I'm bilingual in Arabic, and I try to keep up with Arabic as well as my aviation. So this particular contract was real nice because it put me in an Arabic-speaking country, enjoyed it. Aviation, I started flying as a second career, and once I started flying, early on in my desire to fly, I wanted to be a bush pilot in Africa, preferably with a humanitarian disaster relief organization, and I tracked down AirServe. It took me a few years, but eventually they hired me for a two-year contract in Mozambique, and since that two-year contract in Mozambique, I've pretty much just gone with them about 3 months a year. I've flown for them in West Africa, in Congo, and in the Middle East, and then into Iraq, and then most recently in on this contract in Chad and Sudan.
Now, there's an article I read about AirServe International where they said that all of our pilots are definitely doing it out of the love in their heart because they could be making twice as much flying for private industry back home.
This is true. This is true. Twice as much. I really don't know how much more. But, no, this is developing a lot more memories than a pilot would doing normal work.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. And from when you and I talked before, you told me that you've flown relief missions for wars and famines and volcanoes and all sorts of natural and man-made disasters. You go in and bring people food and medicine, right?
Well, usually the planes I fly are not bringing in food. Unless it's groceries for the staff. It's usually the staff that I fly in, people like Doctors Without Borders, World Vision, CARE International, occasionally Red Cross, though they tend to have their own airplanes, and, of course, staff of the UN. And we do medevacs when the staff people, usually it's the staff people when they get sick or hurt, we fly them out. We do a lot of VIPs come in. They come over to assess the situation or otherwise get in the way, and we fly them over there and fly them around. And also journalists. On this last contract, I flew some prominent journalists from the New York Times and BBC and Asahi Shimbun, Reuters, and so on, because the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, former Dutch Prime Minister, was with us. He came over to inspect what was going on.
All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Bill Kelsey. He's a pilot for AirServe International, recently back from Chad and the Sudan, to tell us all about what's going on there. So we'll be right back after this break on the Weekend Interview Show.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. The guest is Bill Kelsey. He's a pilot for AirServe International. He's just back from Sudan and Chad, where he's been flying around reporters and Red Cross folks and such like that, dealing with what the United Nations at least calls the biggest humanitarian crisis on Earth right now. And that is the civil wars, plural, going on in Sudan. And that's really my first question for you. Bill, there's two different civil wars going on in the Sudan right now?
Oh, possibly more, possibly less, depending on which ceasefire is in effect and which one's broken. The main civil war that people had been familiar with was one between the government and mostly people in the south, mostly non-Arab tribes. The Reader's Digest version is Muslim versus Christian and animist, but there were significant communities of Christian with the government, and there were significant Muslim communities with the Southern Rebellion. That rebellion went on for a good 30 years, and that was the Southern People or Sudan People's Liberation Army by John Garang. That finally came to a conclusion last spring. A deal was worked out where John Garang could get to be vice president. The leaders of his rebellion got their seats in the National Assembly, and oil royalties would be distributed and so on and so forth. In other words, the rebellion was bought off. Now, coincidentally, as this was being worked out, another rebellion started, and I can't help but wonder if it was coincidence or if people thought, well, here's a good way to get some oil royalties for us. And who knows?
Because the oil's all in that southern region of Sudan, right?
And I really don't know precisely the geography of where the oil fields are and exactly where the, usually where there's a civil war, you can find some oil, especially if it comes to international attention. Now, what this latest civil war, the roots, the ancient roots of this second civil war is not actually oil. It would be the quarrel between nomads and peasants.
Now, how does that work?
Well, the peasant goes out, your farmer goes out and plants his tomatoes and cucumbers and whatever he can get growing, and millet and soy out in the desert, and then the nomads come along with their goats and camels and start eating the crops, and the peasant farmer goes out and is yelling and, what are you letting your camels eat my tomatoes for? And they're saying, why are you growing your tomatoes where we're trying to graze our camels? It's your fault. So this, it's not the first time it's happened. In fact, the Cain and Abel myth was probably to symbolize the that quarrel between the peasant and the goat herder.
Now, in this case, the people in Darfur are the peasants or they're the nomads?
Well, both. Both. They're mixed. It's blended. You'd have the townspeople, not just peasants, but townspeople would tend to be from, Masalit and Fur and Zagawa. Those are three African tribes. And then there's one Arabic-speaking tribe called the Tanim or Taimur, I'm not sure. Then the on the other side are more nomadic types, and the media was talking about an Arab-African thing. I was a little concerned that maybe they were exaggerating that to heap some more anti-Arab propaganda on the situation. So I looked into it, and unfortunately, all three definitions of Arab that I know came into play here. They were Arab because they spoke Arabic. They were Arab because they claimed Arabic ancestry, even though they were black, too. And finally, in many parts of the Middle East at certain times and places, the word Arab is used specifically for nomads. So, yes, you did have these Arabs.
And it's the Arabs who control the state there. Correct?
Tending to be, yeah, in the capital. But there are other ethnic groups as well that are playing along. One other little twist to this, by the way, is that there was a gentleman named El-Turabi. And El-Turabi was the spiritual Islamist mentor for the leader Omar Bashir. He's the president, the strong man of Sudan right now. And Turabi was one who was pushing Islamic law and Sharia law and so forth. Turabi, I believe, was also, may have been one of the people who sponsored bin Laden when bin Laden was living in Sudan a long time ago. In other words, they were friends. They may have had a falling out. Now, as it turned out, Turabi and Omar Bashir also had a falling out. And Turabi was in jail. So he was very much part of the government, African in his ancestry, but he was part of the government. Now, he was having a quarrel with the president. He backed this rebellion and lent his moral support to it, and he was accused of leading it. Whether he was just giving moral support or leading it, we don't know. And which is one other interesting point, is in this civil war, both sides were Muslim. They're believing Muslims. I discussed this with them, and they felt very, the Africans, when I was in their refugee camps, and told me they were most definitely Muslims, and it was a Muslim-on-Muslim thing.
But now, this is the most recent rebellion, the one that began in February.
Yeah, and that's the one I was dealing with. Right. I had nothing to do with the one that had been going on in the south. Now, these refugees, when they came over, they went into Chad. And my job was to fly. Most of my flying was flying back and forth across Chad. The capital, N'Djamena, is right at the border with Cameroon on the western side of Chad. And the town of Abéché is over on the east, sort of the eastern capital.
And that's where the refugees are?
Excuse me?
That's where the refugees are then?
Yeah, in Abéché, and at various points along the border, there were other towns like Adré and Iriba and Gosbeda that we landed at. But the international relief workers would come in from Paris, and they'd land in N'Djamena, and so we would be shuttling them back and forth across Chad, and then on occasion we would also take them to various towns up and down the border. We also flew them into Sudan on a few occasions, mainly just across the border into Jenina, a Sudan town. And then there was one flight we took up to Khartoum for the UN High Commissioner of Refugees.
And how long were you there, Bill?
This was a two-month thing.
Okay.
And I go over on these now just to substitute for guys when they need to rotate out and go on vacation, or if there's an emergency startup, or if there's a sudden increase in fighting and more refugees and they need another airplane, that's when I go over.
The World Health Organization says that 10,000 people die per month in the Darfur region, and that 1.8 million people have been driven from their homes. Are those numbers accurate, you think?
Yeah, I tend to plead ignorance about numbers, and even when they're presented to me, there are several things at work here. It's a human tragedy, whether it's 5,000 or 50,000, and one of my reactions is I don't know how they could count. It's whether there's any scientific way to count. And without diminishing the extent of the tragedy, unfortunately, these bureaucracies, the way the world works, a lot of these bureaucracies have a vested interest in there being a problem. I mean, internal to all of the disaster relief, there are plenty of controversies. And so if people are scared into believing that there is a terrible disaster, then money can be raised to address it.
Well, and somewhere in there is a magic number where America gets to come across and do something about it. In fact, this government has already declared that government guilty of genocide.
Yeah. Now, that's an interesting question right there. I mean, there are a lot of definitions of genocide, and I haven't memorized any of them. What I did discover when I was in Sudan, and I had some very good conversations from people, and even when I was in the refugee camp, I found out some of the Zagawa refugees were talking about their relatives that were in Khartoum. Now, here they are telling me angry things about the Sudan government and how I hear these horror stories about how planes drop bombs on their towns and people run out of their cities and villages. But they're talking about Zagawa people being prominent in business in Khartoum. Well, I looked into this when I actually flew into Sudan, and sure enough, even in Adre, there were communities of refugees that were in the town, camped out outside the town and hanging out in the city. The Sudan government is not persecuting people or shooting them or systematically annihilating them. When they're walking around in the cities, there doesn't seem to be any quarrel with them.
So this is not about ethnicity. This is about whose side you're on.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say on that. Again, to go to the background, you have some old tensions between peasants and nomads, which is the core of it. Peasants and nomads, now they'll say Arab and African, which is true, but that's not the core of the problem. It's peasant and nomad. Overpopulation, there are more peasants and more nomads competing for the same arid desert. And
all right, hold it right there, Bill. It's the Weekend Interview Show, everybody, on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Bill Kelsey, Relief Pilot. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I am Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. If anybody wants to listen to the archives of any of the previous interviews, there's about 30-something of them up there so far, and I only interview the best of the best, like my friend Bill Kelsey. He's a pilot for AirServe International, and he spent the last couple of months flying around Chad and the Sudan dealing with the humanitarian crisis there. And now, when we were talking before the break, sir, we were discussing about whether this counts as genocide or not, and you were saying, well, it's funny because the ethnicity of the people who are supposedly being genocided, they're still walking around free in the capital city, so it's not so much about that as it is the contest over land and resources, right?
Yeah, the contest over land, now that sets the stage for the tension. Now, along comes... I mentioned earlier that a peace deal had been worked out with the northern people and the southern people, where the southern people got some groceries from the central government and so on. Maybe by coincidence, maybe by design, that's when two political movements, and there are others, but at least two armed movements from the African side, launched some attacks against the government, and they shot up an airport and destroyed some government airplanes. They killed some officers, including a general, and before we heard about it, there were some very effective and successful attacks. Now, I try not to be too judgmental. I mean, the African community and the peasants, they had some legitimate grievances. They are probably grievances that most people would feel would make it legitimate for them to launch an attack against a government. Now, they launched the attack. They began shooting government officials. They started an armed rebellion. Now, the government, in turn, pretty much did reacted the way the United States is reacting in Iraq about insurgents coming out of Fallujah. You have a town that is harboring insurgents. So what do? You
raise it to the ground.
Well, You attack the villages and run people out. There's, I'm sure, differences and nuances, and maybe the American assault was more high-tech, but basically, yeah, the Sudan government fought an insurgency in order to gain extra manpower for the insurgents. And you have to understand, Sudan is a really huge, huge country with very difficult transportation, and the road system is not the best.
I read that the region of Darfur is even bigger than Texas, just that one part of the country.
Yeah. So what the government basically did was inform, get the word out to the nomadic groups and say, look, stand by us. There are these people rebelling against us.
These are the Janjaweed militias,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah. So the Janjaweed became the aligned with the government. And the thing is, the government didn't have full control. I mean, they released them. They gave them permission. They gave them the green light, but they didn't really control them tactically. So now when the government is backtracking, they're saying, well, it was we can't control them, they're bandits, and so on and so forth. And there's probably some truth to that, but it's also true that while the Janjaweed were attacking, these villages were attacked from the air. I heard this directly from the refugees in Arabic, and they talked to me about it and told me about the Antonovs. And it was very clear. Children drew pictures, and I had some children give me pictures. They were attacked from the air by these planes. They were run out of their towns. And again, the Janjaweed, they were extremely brutal. They ran them out. They terrorized them. But they didn't systematically kill everybody. You know, they ethnically cleansed them. So I don't know if it's right to get into gradations of evil and to say, well, it wasn't quite as evil as it could be, and maybe it's not genocide. We shouldn't use that word loosely. It's not genocide because they're not killing the people that are living in the cities from these same ethnic groups. But it was horrible. It was horrible for the people, and I saw quite a few traumatized women whose families had been wiped out, and it was a very intense experience for me hearing their stories.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Of course, the reason we have to be so careful about the language and the semantics of things like this is, as we talked about before, somewhere there's a magic number or there's a magic word thrown around that justifies the West coming to intervene.
Right.
And, in fact, I was reading the news headlines today. Former Senator John Danforth, our ambassador to the United Nations, lambasted the United Nations for being too weak and refusing to stand up for human rights in the Sudan. And if they're not going to, well, we're just going to have to for them.
Yeah, there is another little twist to this. I saw it in the paper about 3 days ago, 2 inches. There was a, of course, there was a ceasefire. When I flew into the Sudan, there was an official. Now, when you have a ceasefire, that means people break it, and every so often somebody has a point to make, and there's a little ceasefire going on right now. But there was a violation a few days ago, and the consensus from everyone, including the United States, was that these were the rebels that broke the ceasefire.
It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be right back with Bill Kelsey.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. This just in, more American soldiers and Iraqi civilians just died in Iraq, leaving behind heartbroken brothers, fathers, sisters, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and it's your government's fault. Okay, now back to the show. Bill Kelsey is a pilot for AirServe International, and he spent the last couple of months flying around the Sudan. I'm sorry, I just spent the break watching footage of Americans killing people, so I'm a little tweaked. But anyway, the point is, here's what I was going to ask you. Dr. Ron Paul gave a speech on the House floor called Stay Out of Sudan's Civil War. And apparently, I didn't even know about this. TV didn't mention it, but apparently the Congress just passed an act called the Comprehensive Peace in Sudan Act, which I guess says we're going to do something about it if the UN doesn't and such. And Ron Paul points out in this speech that isn't it interesting how there's no oil really in the Congo, and 2 to 3 million people have died in the civil war in the Congo right next door to the Sudan, and yet there's plenty of oil in the Sudan, and where less than a third as many people have died there, we're quick to label it genocide and prepare to move in and intervene in North Africa, which is obviously where North America belongs. What do you think of that, Mr. Kelsey?
Well, I have a hard time believing that the United States would intervene militarily in Sudan right now. I'm sure they would intervene with diplomacy and dollars if they could. The point I was about to make, a very interesting tiny little point, was that the United States government, whatever Danforth said at the UN, the State Department just came out with an announcement that this latest upsurge, the latest violation of the ceasefire, was on the part of the rebels. Now,
is that accurate, or that's
well,
just what the State Department
says? When you read the news on the, and then try to dissect the layers of the onion, it could be that it's the truth. It could be what really happened, or it could be that a fight broke out, and now the real news becomes who condemns it and who blames who. The fact that the both the United Nations and the United States is claiming that it was the rebels' fault this time that the ceasefire was broken, it could mean that it really is the rebels' fault. It could be that they're doing their best to make nice with the Khartoum government right now.
So when they intervene, they can still choose which side they want to intervene on, as long as they're going.
Right. And it was interesting going into Sudan. It's not. I've been in certain totalitarian places where you really just have to be super careful what you say, what happens in a lot of these really horrible situations is that when it's the worst, you're not hearing about it. Once you start hearing about it, the worst is past. And the fact that there are numerous aid organizations in Sudan, the UN for better or worse, U.S. government for better or worse, reporters, journalists, the fact that they're flying into Sudan, the diplomats have come to Sudan, they're trying to work it out, the Islamic world does consider it an embarrassment that it, you know, they're these Muslims misbehaving with each other. The Sudanese government, for all its faults, it's not as rabid as it could be about this. There are people. I just can't get over when I did my first landing in Sudan. There was a big question whether they should let from my company's point of view, whether they should let American pilots land there, whether. It was a U.S. registered aircraft, even though it's painted with has UN symbols on it and so on. The registration number gives it away that it's U.S. So we're a little nervous, but I'd landed there, and there's UN planes, there's some Hind helicopters that fortunately were not flying that day, and they weren't killing anybody since there was a peace agreement on. There were African Union troops being unloaded from another Antonov. There were journalists flying in. Nobody asked me for a flight plan. Nobody asked me for our landing clearance that we'd gone to great trouble to get. Nobody asked me for landing fees. I went up into the control tower to see if there was anything I should do, and they invited me to sit down for breakfast with them and have some nice warm Arabic bread dipping into this bean mash that has all kinds of nice Sudanese spices mixed in, and they got it from some little old ladies that cooked this up on stones and charcoal under the wing of a crashed Antonov outside. They have a little open-air restaurant that was very interesting to look at. And
that doesn't sound too bad for a humanitarian crisis.
No. We're in the town, though. This is a government-controlled town. The whole idea was that, flying into a war zone sometimes it can be surprisingly easy to get into and out of.
So your point is that the Sudanese government didn't really give you a hard time, even though really you're there helping the victims of the Sudanese government.
Right, right. And then the Sudanese government, is not monolithic because they're trying to say, yes, there is this terrible trouble and... but it's only between the nomads and the peasants, and other people are saying, no, your airplanes help do it. But the thing is, there's wiggle room. There's space to operate. It's not going into North Korea. It's not Pol Pot, where the horrible things were happening and no one had a clue about it. So it's the fact that you're able to watch some of this stuff means that it's not as bad as it could be otherwise. And one thing, I found some good news when I was in this town of Jenin. I had a very nice conversation with an educated Arab woman. And she said half of her family was pro-Janjaweed and the other half of her family was pro-peace and staying out of it. She said that there were Sudani Air Force pilots in prison for refusing to participate. And that she was personal friends with a pilot who was... imprisoned for being a dissident. So the fact that they're in prison, it's good that their pilot's refusing. It's bad that they're in prison. It's good that they're not being executed.
Do you think that it could be proper for the West to intervene here and try to force a ceasefire if they can't come to one themselves?
No. Intervention just... in the sense of being watched, if people want to volunteer for Doctors Without Borders, if they want to volunteer for World Vision, if they want to volunteer and go over there and not involve anybody else in this, they can go over there. And I think that's good because it's when people are being watched that they behave. And I did have several Sudanese tell me that the Janjaweed in Jenina, for example, they have to disguise themselves or not make a public appearance, which they were doing earlier in the crisis. They could have victory parades up and down in town. Now that there are foreigners in town, they kind of have to slink off in embarrassment. I mean, they know themselves that they've been doing something that is unsavory and that it is not approved by the rest of the world. Yeah, so people watching, I think that's as much intervention, and once you start getting into too much military stuff, it just poisons the whole atmosphere.
So you think like some people with loving baby blue helmets maybe to come and force the peace, that wouldn't be a solution to this?
Well, usually they don't force it. The UN troops that I've seen in the past, and I have really mixed feelings about this, I have conflicted views, usually they're there to watch. Now, a lot of times they'll take over an airfield, and so a lot of the airfields I land at, some of my contracts in Africa, they are controlled by UN troops, and the UN troops are just there as a deterrent. Now, on the dark side, what often happens, I mean, it's very rare that the UN troops actually get into combat with local folks. Minor skirmishes every now and then, but there's never been any major combat between UN units and local militias. They sort of melt away. There are a few scandals that come up because of sexual abuse of the local people. They tend to be overpaid to begin with, and the money they bring in throws the economy into confusion. That's with a lot of the UN staff and the UN workers. They're just paid way too much, and then they get a per diem that's outlandish.
We can expect prostitution to be the new growth industry in Sudan the more UN people show up?
Oh, possibly. Possibly. I mean, that happens. Sudan has a very interesting history, by the way. Things have gone on there that are studied very closely and by military historians. Most, I'm referring to the rebellion in about 120 years ago by a gentleman who saw himself as the Mahdi. He went around swinging an incense burner and chanting the names of God in Arabic, and Basically, I mean, you hear the word Mahdi in Iraq. Now, those people are just talking about, well, we're preparing the world for the Mahdi. The Mahdi is somebody who's going to come at the end of time and prepare the world for the return of Jesus, okay, so in Islamic mythology. So a lot of people name themselves after the Mahdi, this mythological creature who's going to come. Well, this Sudan, this guy, Muhammad Abdullah ibn Sayyid Abdullah, saw himself as the Mahdi, and he led an armed rebellion. I mean, he really made Osama bin Laden look like a Cub Scout because he rallied people to him. And the British sent somebody down to deal with him named General Chinese Gordon, who made Oliver North look like a Cub Scout also. And the Mahdi came out ahead. This General Gordon lost his head in the process, and then he died there. And the Mahdi, he ruled an empire there for, he died 3 months later, and then his successor managed to hold it together for another 15 years or so before the English sent down another invasion, and that's where Winston Churchill got his start as a war criminal, along, and Kitchener was involved as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. The Mahdi, I visited his tomb, actually. He was buried there right across the Nile from Khartoum in Omdurman. Like I say, after he killed his main protagonist, then he died of something or other. And when Kitchener came down, he smashed up the tomb, took the skeleton out, and threw the bones in the Nile. And according to the legend, he took the skull and made it into an inkwell, which he carried with him to India. But they still have the tomb there, and it's not clear that the local people know that it's emptied out. And then the tomb's renovated, and so on.
So do they have sort of a long memory about this kind of British intervention back 120 years ago? Would they make the parallel between that and say if America tried to come intervene now?
Absolutely they would. I don't know. They know that the Mahdi was this national hero, and they have his tomb there. But of course, even when the British were doing this, I mean, they had lots of local allies. I mean, there was a civil war in Sudan. They had Egyptian soldiers and various Sudani tribes aligned themselves with the British. So, I mean, this guy was not universally loved by everybody in Sudan, but he did manage to put himself together a kingdom for a while, or an empire. I bought an eighth grade textbook to read exactly what they say about the Mahdi himself. I mean, it's clear what they would say about the British coming in. They don't like it. That was imperialist and all of that. But what they would have to say about the Mahdi, especially since he's claiming to be more than just a nationalist revolutionary. He was he's claiming to be the, like the Messiah.
Right. So what do the textbooks say?
I haven't read it yet, I'm sorry to say. But I suspect that they might have a problem, or there would be some reservation about how far they would go as in terms of claiming him as a national father of their country or anything. And Sudan's been divided by some very interesting divisions. When I was walking down this market area in Omdurman, not far from the Mahdi's tomb, I saw a guy preaching. And my co-pilot was a young American woman, and wanted to be going into a shop nearby, and the guy preaching just was a little bit too angry when he preached, and there was a crowd around him. I thought we'd better go a few blocks away, and we went into another shop, and I asked, I said, "Who?" I suspected he was a Wahhabi, and sure enough, the storekeeper said, "He's a Wahhabi. I don't like him. He doesn't like our rituals." And I said, "What rituals are you talking about?" "Well, this fellow was a Sufi. And he did all sorts. They do rituals with drums and chanting, and the Wahhabis are very puritanical, and basically anything that they feel has been added as a ritual in the last 13 centuries, they would do away with." And So that was what I experienced in Sudan itself, in the capital. And you know, and the fact that I could walk into a store and have a discussion about theology, it's not a total, complete totalitarian society.
Well, I guess that implies that the Wahhabists aren't the ones that run that country, then.
No, there are several Sufi orders, and it's hard to say. I mean, Tarabi was a major theologian, and he was part of the government, and he was part of the one enforcing some of the Islamic rules that people were objecting to, and it was inspiring them to rebel against the government. And in the first civil war we're talking about, now this second civil war in Darfur, here he is as one of the mentors of that very same rebellion that people in the West are shedding crocodile tears over. And I don't know if they're aware of that Tarabi has taken the side of these rebels. But when you have a war in these countries, the war is always the worst outcome, whatever the original grievance. The war messes things up and costs a lot more and gets a lot more people killed. And this business in Iraq, I mean,
let's hold that discussion till we get back.
All right,
it's Bill Kelsey is the guest on the Weekend Interview Show today. He's a pilot for AirServe International. He's just back from Chad and Sudan, where he's been helping out the refugees. And we'll come back and talk a little bit about Iraq. So stay tuned, everybody. We're going to come back and wrap up the Weekend Interview Show right after this. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Wrapping up here with Bill Kelsey. He's a pilot for AirServe International, a non-governmental organization, and he flies around usually the crews of humanitarian aid workers, and has recently been in the Sudan. So we're talking all about that. And as a segue into the last few minutes here on Iraq, sir. By the way, everybody, Bill Kelsey was raised in Jordan and is fluent in Arabic and knows a whole lot about that part of the world, and has been, in fact, has flown relief missions into war-torn Iraq as well. But in surfing news articles about Sudan, preparing for this interview, sir, I saw that the government in Khartoum has actually called the killing of civilians in their counterinsurgency, they have adopted the term collateral damage from the American military.
Right. And what happens?
It's funny, you know, Timothy McVeigh called it collateral damage,
yeah,
and everybody scorned him, but our government can call it that, and that's just fine.
Yeah. Well, I heard Timothy McVeigh referred to collateral damage, too, when was asked about the kids that were killed,
right,
in the federal building. But
and we know who trained him.
Yeah. So I think, the reality is that rebels, you can point fingers if you think that's constructive. I don't, but we can, rebels rebel against a government. The government says, well, we have to get rid of these rebels while they're hiding among civilians. Usually when you hear people analyze, you can tell quite often, have they taken the side of the rebels who are in the city, or have they taken the side of the government? In my view, you know, what's happening in Fallujah is very similar to what happened in Darfur. Now, the mainstream view on that from an American point of view, the mainstream view that many Americans have bought into is that, well, these are nasty insurgents. They're hiding among civilians. What can we do if they shoot from a building and we drop a bomb on that building and it destroys a few buildings nearby? Or if the bomb misses and hits the building next door, it's still the fault of the insurgent. Of course, a decision is made somewhere that we're going to be sympathetic with the villagers who've been ethnically cleansed or the townspeople, then you hear about genocide and you hear about how terrible it is that there's a Sudan government dropping bombs on these people and making them run out into the desert. I suspect that if we were talking to Iraqi refugees from Fallujah, I would be hearing, you know, the same traumatized people in the same voices describing very similar events as what the Darfur civilians were describing to me in the camp in Naribu when I was there.
Okay, well, there's your parallel, everybody. You are the government of Sudan. Hope you like it. Thanks a lot, Bill, for coming on the show, everybody. Bill Kelsey is a pilot for AirServe International and has been spending time flying around helping with the humanitarian crises, plural, in the Sudan. Thank you very much again for joining me on the show today, Bill.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, everybody, that's it for the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be back next week from 3 to 5 Texas time. You can check out all the archives at weekendinterviewshow.com. Thanks. Talk to you next week.